Call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water and open an informational meeting on ethanol. And we're going to begin with this today. We may be interrupted at some point to do the work session on 2184. So, committee members, I'd ask that you not leave for longer than a bathroom break and keep it brief because we may be moving to that at some point. But we're going to start with this informational meeting. I'd like to have Dave Vantoff and Mike Graney and Rick Wallace come up. There's a second panel to follow, and I've asked these four or five speakers in total keep their comments to 15 minutes, and I'm including questions and answers, gentlemen, so that means very brief.
About 15 minutes each?
No, it's 15 okay. minutes in total. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Antoff from the governor's office, for the record, and there, in light of all the testimony you're going to hear today at this informational hearing, I'm going to be very brief, but wanted to just at least start things off by reminding the committee about kind of how we got here in terms of the ethanol and biofuels policy in the state. As you all know, in a partnership with the governor and the legislature in 2007, we passed some landmark legislation around biofuels, both for ethanol and biodiesel. And really, in our view, the purpose of the legislation was threefold. First, it was to create incentives for the generation of feedstock production in Oregon, to try and move our agricultural markets towards opportunities in the fuels markets. Second, it was to encourage processing and infrastructure capacity in Oregon to produce biofuels here in the state and the jobs that are created with that. And you're going to hear plenty of, I think, testimony from folks that have been doing just that in the state. And third, by establishing the fuel standard, the blending requirements, was to create the demand for the biofuels that were going to be grown and processed locally in Oregon. So it was really a three-pronged approach: create the demand, create the infrastructure, and then generate the feedstock for the fuels. We've seen the governor's view. We've seen tremendous success with the program in just a couple of years. We've got a strong and growing biofuels market, both in terms of ethanol and biodiesel in the state. And really, I'd say the fourth prong of this was to try and establish the industry here and put Oregon on the map in terms of biofuels so that we would be competitive in terms of the research and technology and development that's going to be continuing to go through this industry as we transition from food-based fuels to cellulosic-based fuels. And I think, again, you're going to hear some testimony today that we've been successful in that and landed some of the cutting-edge projects around cellulosic technology and development in the state. So from our view, the big picture, this has been a strong success with the fluctuation in gas prices that has at times put us in a strong beneficial position in terms of the blending and long-term projections of gas prices. We think it's going to put us in a strong position in terms of fuel prices as we integrate ethanol and biodiesel into the system. And lastly, just as a reminder, the governor strongly believes this is an important part of his climate policy and getting reductions, climate reductions, carbon reductions in our transportation fuels sector. And we've definitely been achieving that with the blending of biofuels into the system. So I'm just going to leave it there and then hand it over to Mike Graney.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. I'll just give you some brief remarks. I have a more detailed written statement. But we also believe that this is good energy policy. The course we're on, that House Bill 2210 that you passed in 2007, is the right course for promoting biofuels and giving us alternatives in the transportation sector. That's critically important to our over-reliance on imported oil. There were issues that arose with implementation of the bill, and those were addressed in 2008 in Senate Bill 1079. And I think as issues come up, they need to be addressed. But the basic course that we're on, promoting biofuels, has environmental, energy, and economic benefits for Oregon, and we encourage you to continue that. Let me add that most of the bills we have concerns about that are before the committee, especially the committee today, in terms of taking us off that course. The exception of that is House Bill 3463, which I notice has been removed from today's panel, but we do support that bill, Representative Jensen's bill, to clarify the triggering date for the biodiesel. That would make that consistent with the trigger you had for the renewable fuel standard for ethanol. That mechanism, which is based on capacity instead of actual production, helped the ethanol industry move forward successfully, and I think it makes sense to do that for biodiesel in Oregon as well. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from members of the committee for either gentleman? Just a brief note, we did remove, I think it's 3416, from today's public hearing schedule. We added it to Tuesday's public hearing schedule, knowing the kind of weight of the work in front of us with these five ethanol bills, that being somewhat different subject, related subject, biodiesel. We'll hear that bill on Tuesday, and I hope Representative Jensen heard that. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Stephanie Page or Lauren Henderson, or both?
Chair Cannon, Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. With me is Stephanie Page. She's our renewable energy specialist. Stephanie has a PowerPoint presentation that we'll go through in light speed. I think you have a copy of that presentation. Just for a little bit of background, the Department of Agriculture Weights and Measures Division was the program that was responsible for the implementation of the introduction of the 10% ethanol. And with that, I will let Stephanie go.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stephanie Page. I'm a renewable energy specialist with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and I'll go very quickly through this update about ethanol and our renewable fuel standard in Oregon. So we currently have the renewable fuel standard for ethanol in effect in Oregon. Most of our gasoline sold in Oregon now is 10% ethanol. There are a few exceptions for uses such as small aircraft, watercraft, ATVs, power tools, and several other things. We also have a national renewable fuel standard, and that mandated 11.1 billion gallons of renewable fuels to be sold in 2009. It's going to go up every year. And in our nationally, in our gasoline, about 70% of the gasoline sold in the United States is blended with ethanol. Most of that is E10 or 10% ethanol. Our biodiesel standard has not yet taken effect in Oregon. The production trigger has not yet been reached. As far as impacts, as you heard, one of the goals of the renewable fuel standard was economic development. There has been significant investment in ethanol facilities in Oregon, as well as biodiesel facilities and the supporting industry. As far as impacts to agriculture, they have been mixed depending on the sector. They've allowed for alternative rotational crops for some folks. For folks that are located close to ethanol or biodiesel plants, some of the co-products can be used for feed. On the other hand, there have been concerns in the livestock industry about the impacts of using certain crops for biofuels on feed prices. When cellulosic ethanol becomes commercially available, and we don't know exactly the timeline for that yet, that should hopefully change some of the impacts to feed prices and also even broaden the list of crops that folks can use to produce biofuels and create even more alternatives for our growers in Oregon. And one question we get frequently is the impact of ethanol and biofuels on food costs. And our response is it has had an impact, but there are a variety of factors that have contributed to food prices in 2008. Just a few of them include speculative buying. There was a lot of speculative buying of commodities during 2008. Certainly our energy, oil, and fertilizer prices were very high in 2008 and pushed up food prices and production costs. There was increasing global demand for grains. China and India and other developing countries are looking for more grains for livestock feed, for example. And labor costs and also our lower U.S. dollar last year increased export demand for grains. So those are just a few other factors that contributed to our food price increases during 2008. Another question we get frequently is about the the benefits of ethanol and biofuels on the environment, especially the greenhouse gas emissions. That's been an issue lately. And so the take-home message of this slide is that the studies that are shown below the solid line showed a greenhouse gas benefit or a reduction from using ethanol over gasoline. So as you can see, there has been some disagreement, and these looked at direct emissions associated with production. They don't look at indirect land use change, and that's been a topic of controversy lately. One study that was recently released showed a 60% gain in greenhouse gas reductions of ethanol over gasoline. So enough to even account for secondary land use changes and still show a greenhouse gas reduction benefit.
Let me stop you for just a minute. Representative Denson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just a little curious. You had a 2005 date on that. In this particular arena, that looks like pretty old date to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, one of the more recent studies was released in 2009. It was released in the Journal of Industrial Ecology, and it documented a 60% greenhouse gas reduction over conventional gasoline. So I'd be happy to send that to the committee if you'd like to look at that.
Would you please provide the access number or
absolutely.
Sort of thing for me? Thank you.
Some issues that we got calls about last year as the ethanol standard was taking effect across Oregon were about the performance of biofuels and impacts on vehicle fuel economy and just overall vehicle performance. And we told folks to always check their owner's manual. Many vehicle owner's manuals say that 10% ethanol is okay to use in the vehicle. That doesn't mean that there may not be some problems. There could be concerns to the vehicle's fuel system, especially if it hasn't been maintained. Ethanol could clean out deposits in the gas tank and cause fuel filter clogging, for example. If the vehicle's oxygen sensor isn't working properly, there could be some initial issues with using E10. But generally, vehicles manufactured since the early 1980s should perform fine on 10% ethanol. And I asked a couple of folks within the manufacturing industry for their perspectives on E10, and I wanted to share this quote from the senior technical specialist with the National Engine Builders Association. They recently completed an engine failure analysis booklet, and ethanol was not listed as one of the causes of engine failure. He hasn't heard of an engine failure due to an ethanol fuel mixture. This is from Ellen Shapiro from the National Alliance of Auto Manufacturers, just saying that it's very difficult to document damage from fuel in general and from ethanol. Moving on to fuel economy. Theoretically, there's 3.3% less energy in a 10% blend of ethanol. Ethanol has about 67% of the energy of a gallon of gasoline, gallon for gallon. So that it works out to 3.3% less energy in a 10% blend. We did get folks reporting a higher fuel economy loss than that. We're not sure what was going on there. One gentleman experienced a learning curve in his new vehicle, and his fuel economy improved over time while he was using E10. I wanted to share a study prepared by the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, just saying that consumer concerns didn't take into account several other factors when they were looking at fuel economy loss associated with ethanol blends. And then finally, I wanted to mention off-road performance. That was a concern that we heard and that the legislature addressed by passing Senate Bill 1079 in the 2008 session, allowing several exemptions to the renewable fuel standard for off-road uses. Many manufacturers have okayed the use of 10% ethanol, but for folks who are concerned about using it in power tools and ATVs, they can buy non-blended fuel. And our Measurement Standards Division maintains a list of stations that sell non-blended fuel, and that is posted on the Oregon State Marine Board website. And that's my last slide, so happy to take any questions.
Thanks very much. You might have generated one or two. The committee is quiet. In that case, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate having the slides here.
We have one quick question. Some of the complaints that I've been getting from my district are the availability of gas without ethanol to use in their boats and planes and things. So what is being done for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, is a decision that's up to the individual retailer if it's economical for them to dedicate a pump to selling straight gasoline. So that has been an issue. And one individual mentioned he thought there might be an education issue among fuel retailers. Maybe some of them aren't aware that they can sell unblended fuel. So that is something that could be addressed.
Mm-hmm. One of the problems with that is finding fuel to be delivered to them.
Mm-hmm.
That's been an issue. A lot of our people were going up to Washington State. Now they're doing the same thing, so we're wondering where we can send them. That's a reasonable drive.
Okay.
In your boat, your plane.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if they've looked at our website and seen if there's some, or the Marine Board website, but that, I guess that's where I would look first, is the Marine Board website, and see if there is something somewhat close to them.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're going to be coming back to this subject in a moment, but for now I'm going to close the informational hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2184. And I'm going to ask our interim committee administrator, Rick Berkobian, to describe what we have in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You do have a hand-engrossed version of House Bill 2184. Just ignore, again, lines 12 through 30. They're crossed off, and the rest of it is engrossed. These are the dash 3, dash 5, and dash 10 amendments that you adopted. We subsequently had all three of those sets of amendments merged into one set of amendments called the dash 12s. And so the fiscal impact statement that you see is on the dash 12s, but just be aware that these are just a combination of the three sets of amendments, and you do not have to therefore adopt the dash 12. You've already adopted those three amendments. You have an engrossed version. You have the amendments. Would you like me to review the bill again, or are they well aware of the content?
Given the several public hearings and one previous work session on the bill, I have a feeling that members are pretty well acquainted with the content of the amended bill, and we'll maybe deal with that in discussion after I get a motion. So if you want to add anything else, Rick.
And we do have a letter from the Speaker to allow the subsequent referral to Ways and Means to be rescinded.
Thank you. Could I get a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2184 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and rescind the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 2184 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many people on the committee and in the audience from Thursday loved and requested my speech about, you know, the fortune cookie, but I'm going to refrain from that despite the popular demand. I just have to say that if we're going to go forward, I wish we wouldn't, but I cannot understand the wisdom of the 24 empty beverage container portion of this. We're ordering redemption centers, and this seems to be completely counterproductive and environmentally unsound, and I don't understand why we want two systems, the old system and the new system. And if there was one thing that I particularly find objectionable and puzzling, it would be that section. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just one thing?
That's it.
We're doing well.
Thank you, Representative Boone.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I too wish we could wait, but since we've discussed all this, and I will give my vote today with the reservation of possibly changing on the floor if we find that what we're voting on today changes drastically and does not reflect the goodwill and intent of our works thus far.
Thank you for that comment, Representative Boone, and for bringing it to my attention, your concerns to my attention in advance. I appreciate that. Any further comment? Representative Jensen.
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to have to oppose the measure today, in spite of, you know, a great deal of sympathy with the idea of the bottle bill and support for a cleaner environment. I really think we went through a major, maybe long overdue, but a major revision of the bottle bill last time with the addition of water containers to the containers that we're going to be picking up. We haven't even gone through a full cycle, to understand what the issues and problems may or may not be with that. And, in fact, if I understand correctly, we haven't gone through a summer season with the redemption of those containers. So it just seems to me that we may be at least one session premature on this. And for that reason, I'm going to have to vote no, even though there's some regret on my part.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'll be voting yes, but I wanted to appreciate the chair's efforts at compromise on this. I don't know if it's going to help it pick up any votes on committee, but I do think it demonstrated a willingness to compromise that is probably productive. Even if it may teach you in the, it may make you wonder whether you want to compromise in the future if it doesn't pick up any votes. But I do think it's really important for us to be proceeding as best we can with intelligence and moderation. I appreciate your work on that.
Thanks for that comment. Any further discussion on the motion? Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I want to echo Representative Jensen's remarks. I'll be joining him in voting no, but I also want it clear that I understand the value of the bottled bill and I understand the wonderful things it's done. I fear, like others, that we are placing a pretty heavy burden on the device. And, of course, as you all know, I'm very concerned about the 10-cent issue. So I'm just kind of hoping for the best, but I'll be joining him in voting no.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Let me just add my 5 cents. The process on this... That was supposed to be funny.
There you go.
This bill was the product of a task force, as you all know, that met for a year. Many of the people in the audience attended some or many of those meetings. They did hard work. I served on that committee, spent hours and hours deliberating. There was a lot of public testimony. I just want to speak a little bit to the process that got us to this point. Then, of course, this committee took up the recommendations of that task force. We had, I think, 3 sessions of public hearing, including a work session in which we dealt with the amendments. We took some of the recommendations of that task force and didn't take others, including the decision not to include wine and liquor containers in the list and postponing that 10-cent increase until 2016 at the earliest. I would also, acknowledge that it was the recommendation, one recommendation we did pick up on was the expansion of product, and that to me is the heart of the bill. Of course, that expansion doesn't occur until 2013, so we've set this marker, if we pass this bill, if this crosses the governor's desk, that we will not expand product until 2013. Which remains 4 years away. And I guess my sort of big picture view of this is, given the success of the bottle bill, given the extraordinary work that industry has done to make the system work, especially in the last year with the addition of water bottles, and with the growing percentage of the container beverage stream that juice and tea and sports drinks represent, it makes sense to be looking long-term, looking at 2013 as the date to bring those into the bill. And just last final comment, the bill doesn't, and I think there's a certain amount of confusion about this, related to redemption centers, and it's exciting to me to know that this redemption center concept, which was embedded in the original bill, is being taken up by industry, by distributors and retailers. That plan comes from them. There's nothing in this bill that orders, requires, or expects redemption centers. There is a provision, as Representative Gilliam noted, that requires the retailers to maintain some level of in-store take-back, even if they participate in the redemption center concept. But there is nothing about this bill that requires those redemption centers to go forward. I, along with many others, anticipate and expect that they will, because they are committed to helping make the bottle bill work, and there are business models that work for that. And I'm excited that we'll be back here in 2011 evaluating what we've done today, looking at the growth of redemption centers, and feeling confident about the addition of product in 2013. So with that, seeing no further discussion, I would ask that Sue call the roll.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Vince?
No.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliatt?
No.
Chair Cannon?
Aye. The motion carries. And the bill is sent as amended to the floor. I will carry it. And with that, I'll close the informational the work session on House Bill 2184.
A lot of information.
That was work. And we're going to switch gears here and open a public hearing on the five bills that are posted on our agenda today. So I'll do that and say a few words about what we're expecting. So opening a public hearing on House Bills 2559. I don't have to gavel each time, do
no,
I?
No, you don't.
Thank goodness. 2725, 3086, 3177, and 3277. All these bills relate to ethanol. They have sponsors who I expect to be in attendance, so I think we're going to begin by hearing from legislators. We may have to wait for a moment.
We're looking for them.
We're looking for Representative Edwards to kick us off. But I would ask the public, you're invited to testify on any of these bills, on one or more of these bills. You probably will not find the chair particularly stern, even if you testify more generally about ethanol, since clearly that is the common theme here. So, we have Representative Weir, and I'm happy to start with him if he's ready.
Wow, walk in the room and it happens.
Hey, you're the. Sometimes just being here is.
Are you ready?
All that matters.
Really?
I think we can start with you, okay. And I will. And Representative Hammond.
Yes.
So, to the legislators just coming in the room, I think you understand we have five bills open. We have an hour and a half, roughly, to hear them. We have considerable public interest as well as a number of legislators signed up to testify. So I'm not going to be so rude as to cut off my colleagues, but we'll ask that you try to keep your comments relatively brief. And with that, Representative Weiner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing House Bill 2725. Let me briefly describe the purpose of the bill and then make my case for it. What House Bill 2725 does is to repeal the tax credits that are currently available in the state for people who are growing food for foodstuffs or food that feeds animals that are then part of the food chain for the biofuels industry. What House Bill 2725 does not do, pardon me, I'm dealing with the flu. What House Bill 2725 does not do is impact the tax credit or repeal the tax credit for things like woody debris or used cooking oil or cellulosics, things that are not part of the human food chain. I have put up a political cartoon that, and in the long fashion of political cartoons, that actually says... The picture is worth a thousand words. Says a lot more than, and says it a lot better than I'm probably going to today. But we have a serious issue with the biofuels industry diverting our agricultural products into our transportation fuel system, and the impact that that then has on food prices. And my concern, and the reason for this bill, is that although Oregon may be a small contributor agriculturally to the world food supply, any effect that we have that raises the price of food for the world's poor, I believe has a moral component to it, and we have to address that very seriously. Just as with anything that we might do that would raise the cost of health insurance, and that in turn causes some people not be able to afford health insurance, it has a consequence. Anything we do that raises the price of food also has a consequence. As that price goes up, the world's poorest people can't afford food, and someone, somewhere, starves to death. We may not see them, and they may be very, very far away, but their life matters. We talk a lot in Oregon about climate change and the need to do something about climate change, and the argument that I hear is that, well, Oregon may be a very, very small contributor to, on the issue of carbon emission, but it, what we do is symbolic, and it's important for Oregon to do something in a symbolic way to contribute on that subject. Well, I think the argument is the same here. We may be a very, very tiny player on world food prices, but we ought to not be part of the problem. And the other thing that I would mention is that an issue that is very, very important in Oregon, because I read about it, and there's in the paper constantly, and there is serious concern, is hunger in Oregon. And I think that's a serious issue, and we should be concerned about it. But I think we also ought to be concerned about hunger outside of Oregon, across the world. And whatever hunger issues we have in this state pale in comparison to the kind of hunger issues that people in third world countries deal with, where it literally is a life and death situation for them. And as world food prices move up, people actually lose their lives, something that I don't think is necessarily true in Oregon. I have brought with me today Dr. Perry from Oregon State University, who will contribute to the conversation and probably in a more intellectual way than I just did. So I'll turn it over to him.
Representative Winger, before we get to Professor, I'd like to invite Representatives Hannah and Freeman up to give their presentations. And if you are able to stick around, I know they have to get back to committee. You may too. But let's go ahead and hear from Representatives Hannah and Freeman, if that's all right.
Sure.
Thank you. Gentlemen, come on up. And we'll, if you could take a seat, sir, and
okay.
we'll have you back up here in a moment.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the members here for their indulgence with busy schedules. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, colleagues, I'm here today to give testimony on House Bill 3177. Basic description there is excluding ethanol from premium fuel. I'm Bruce Hanna, State Representative, House District 7 out of Douglas County. I very much appreciate you all hearing this piece of legislation, and I appreciate that a number of members, including my colleague to the left, Representative Freeman, Garrard, Schaffler, and Edwards, Chris Edwards, and others on both sides of the aisle supporting this piece of legislation, because I do believe it truly is a bipartisan issue and one that is important to many, many Oregonians. As I mentioned, House Bill 3177 is a very simple bill. It allows for premium gasoline to be sold in the state without having to contain ethanol. Like many of you, after the 10% ethanol mandate was implemented last year, I began to hear from Oregonians from around the state who were concerned with both performance and damage possibilities to their engines and equipment. In particular, I heard from a number of aviators and boat owners who were concerned about the safety risks that the ethanol fuel could pose. As you will recall, last year during the February special session, we passed Senate Bill 1079, which allows for a gasoline dealer to sell gas that does not contain ethanol if the gasoline is to be used in certain motor vehicles and tools. Those motor vehicles include antique vehicles, vintage aircraft, watercraft, and snowmobiles. As a result of the passage of Senate Bill 1079, some dealers around the state, and I say some, it is very few, now sell ethanol-free gasoline to customers who own vehicles and tools listed in that Senate bill. Unfortunately, that Senate bill did not completely deal with the issue, and as you know, there are people who are experiencing problems with the ethanol-blended fuel. House Bill 3177 helps address this issue by allowing for premium gasoline that does not contain ethanol to be sold in our state. I would ask that you would vote in favor of House Bill 3177 and pass it to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Colleagues, I'd also like you to note that in the bill itself, and I'm not a scientist in this issue, but ethanol, as was described by the writer of the legislation, is 92 octane. We are open to that adjustment, as some of the fuel folks have said, we may want to move that to 91 because depending on the brand, that could be an issue when we describe premium fuel. So if it's 90 or 91 or 92, whatever the fuel dealers decide is premium fuel, we're completely agreeable to. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Hannah. Representative Freeman.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Freeman, and I'm state representative from House District 2. I come before you this afternoon to testify in support of House Bill 3177, both as a state representative and a service station owner for over 18 years. I have unique insight to this issue. Please allow me to take a few minutes to comment about the bill, and I'll try to be brief. The current ethanol mandate that was recently passed contains a list of items the legislature, you all, or some of you all, identified that needed to have clear fuel. House Bill 3177 allows for a point of access for gasoline that does not contain clear fuel. So we've identified there's a need in the bill or in the law, and this bill helps get that access. Right now, many people and businesses that use tools fueled with gasoline are experiencing problems accessing clear fuel. And because of that, they are having problems with their equipment that they're having to use ethanol fuel in. And it's all types of equipment. One of the industries that came to me was the logging industry and chainsaws. They're having a hard time getting their chainsaws to run with the ethanol fuel blend, and they can't get it from anywhere else. I've heard from many people with concerns they're getting worse gas mileage. I have a full-service shop at my station, and a lot of folks in their older cars are really struggling with the fuel mileage. And they're also concerned that the cost of maintenance with their vehicles and equipment has gone up. They're having to do much more maintenance. House Bill 3177 may make it easier for more Oregonians to get gasoline that does not contain ethanol. This is especially important in rural areas of the state. House Bill 3177 allows for gas stations to offer ethanol-free premium gasoline. It does not mandate it. This will allow the market to dictate the amount of access. I want to thank Chair Cannon and the members for allowing me to testify in support of this bill. This is a good bill. It deserves your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great questions for either legislator. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Freeman, as a service station owner, you'd be able to tell us if there's still clean fuel or clear fuel available. It was my understanding is that it's kind of hard to come by now.
It's becoming increasingly hard to come by because they're, I'm sorry, Chair Cannon, Representative Vince, it's becoming hard to come by, which creates this point of access. And I believe the reason it's hard to come by is we've eliminated the market. We've said to folks that, you know, if you're going to sell this, you have to put in a new tank and a new pump and have a completely another complete product line that most stations aren't willing to invest in. Like I said, this is not a mandate. It doesn't remove the ability for stations to sell ethanol premium if that's what they want to sell. It simply lets those areas that think they have a better market for non-ethanol fuel to look for that supply and to try to fill that market.
Follow-up? I'm correct, I hope, in assuming that if the premium brand was allowed, you already have tankage available for it. It's just simply a matter of putting it into the premium tank where it used to be. Is that correct? And then you have it available and you have the clean fuel without having to add another entire tank system.
That's the intent of the bill, yes.
Right. Thank you.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Freeman, are there types of engines that run better or exclusively on premium fuel?
Well, as identified in the current law, there's a list of type of equipment, watercraft, airplanes, all those things that not only run better, but they require that type of fuel. Aircraft, for example, with ethanol in it doesn't work because of the altitude and the freezing up and stuff. So absolutely, yes.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Are there also, say, types of motorcycles or cars or things like that that might as well?
I would believe that any of your antique-type motorcycles, a lot of people believe air-cooled motorcycles run better without the ethanol fuel. And a lot of the older cars, when I say older, I don't mean antique as classified in the current law. I mean older as in the mid-70s cars and whatnot that that folks are trying to run the ethanol fuel in, and it's causing them problems.
Paul? And by the way, that means antique to me. But
that's not the definition of antique.
That wasn't a follow-up, though. I'm curious, then, what distinguishes an engine that runs on premium fuel from an engine that doesn't? What characteristics of the engine? Perhaps this may not be your experience.
Well, and I'm not going to get too technical. Specifically, premium, non-premium isn't really the issue. It's ethanol and non-ethanol. So cars that were made that before ethanol was invented, or before it was a part of a fuel that we use, a lot of the rubber components in the fuel lines and some of the gaskets and the carburetors and different parts just aren't set up for ethanol, and ethanol is causing issues with the materials in the fuel system.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you both very much. Oh, question for Representative Smith.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. This very interesting subject matter. My dad is in the audience. My dad hates ethanol, not just the taste, but just the whole deal. The question I would have is about the choice of the premium gasoline. It seems sensible, or at least seems very open to argument, that we'd want a non-ethanol option in the marketplace for somebody who could realistically go and choose that if they wanted to choose that. The question I'd have, and it's a minor thing, but something we might think about, if the choice of premium, to say that premium gasoline shall heretofore not be required to have ethanol, and that might mean that most premium gasoline doesn't have ethanol in it, might that have some brand impact on ethanol gas, such that if I want to buy nice gas, it doesn't have ethanol in it? And if I'm getting ethanol, that means it's bad gas, and that, in fact, might help be a self-fulfilling prophecy, which might make my dad happy, but might make, you know, ethanol folks really bummed out.
I really appreciate you asking that question, because that's why we have the word may in there.
Yeah.
There are some markets that will choose to continue to sell premium fuel with ethanol in it, because that is what their market is looking for and asking for. There is other areas that will make the business choice, and it's a gamble. You don't know who is going to want once, but it lets the market decide how that's going to work out best.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if I might comment on that, just if you think about the rural resorts in Oregon, for example, Diamond Lake, Lake of the Woods, and I could go on and on and on, but they cater to boaters in the summertime and spring, and they cater to snowmobilers in the wintertime, and they have very limited fuel services. So you're not talking about a Shell station on I-5. You're talking about a mountain resort place. If you give them the option in those places, you might likely find where they make the choice to have their premium be clear premium, because they have a built-in customer. Ditto, go to the coast where all the four-wheelers and all the boaters fuel. Those station owners might decide this is the right place for ethanol-free premium, because, again, it gives those folks a choice. Transfer to downtown Eugene, where you don't have people filling up four-wheelers or boats, that might be the place where that station says, hey, we're good to go with our premium being ethanol-based.
Further questions? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hannah brought up an issue that does come from my district, and that is the boating. And my own husband will haul his boat across from, if he's fishing in Garibaldi, he will still haul it across the Astoria Megler Bridge to fuel up in Astoria, or in Washington State, where he can find it. He has to go up to, I think, Iwako. Either that or run the boat up, and that's probably not a good choice in all times of the year. But that's where he will get his fuel. So if you could take that on advisement and consider that in those certain places where it's likely to be requested and required as a convenience to people in that sense, or flip it around and make the ethanol optional. I mean, it's because you're going to still need clear gas.
I'm certainly interested. I appreciate bringing the bill forward, and certainly interested in hearing more from perhaps others in the audience as they testify about what doing something like this would mean in terms of our fuel delivery system. Will it be available, I guess, is sort of the question. And it sounds like your view is, yes, the Diamond Lake Resort operator will have a supplier who they can go to for ethanol-free premium gas. And I've heard other stories, too. So, and obviously, we have this national mandate that's helping drive ethanol policy. So I'll look forward to hearing more about that subject as we hear from others. But thanks very much. I'll let you get back to Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a disincentive, of course, to buy the premium. You have to pay a higher price. But there's a percentage of premium products sold in Oregon. I heard it was 7%. Is that correct?
I don't have... Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, I would tell you that's probably accurate. I mean, I don't have that number in front of me. That is a little higher than what my percentage is at my station, so that's probably accurate.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We're going to go on with our legislators' testimony. So Representatives Gilman and Chris Edwards, who I saw in the back of the room at least. Ah, he's still here. Come on up. And I understand you're testifying on different bills. At least I believe that's the case. And Senator Metzger, did you want to testify on one of these bills? Or?
Bill, but I can tell you about premium gasoline and compression ratio.
Thank you. All right, so just here to watch. And Representative Gilman, do you want to begin and tell us which bill you're testifying on? Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative George Gilman, District 55. In the last session, a special session, we passed some legislation that's supposed to solve the problem for boats, airplanes, antique aircraft, and the power saws and that sort of thing. I committed at that time to instigate legislation if I found in my district that non-ethanol gasoline was not available, and that happens to be the case. In southern Oregon, in the Medford area, we seem to be fine. We've got a supplier there. But you go to Prineville, Lakeview, you cannot find a supply. There's different ways. When we passed this bill in 2007, we're told that there was going to be cellulosic ethanol available very soon. To my knowledge, there's still not an economical plant putting out cellulosic ethanol. I really think we jumped ahead of ourselves a little bit on this piece of legislation, and we really should just remove the ethanol. That's what my bill 2559 does, and I'm supportive of that. But the truth of the matter is, I want to solve the problem, and I'm not don't have a lot of pride of authorship. So if you can just figure out a way to exempt premium gasoline from ethanol, that I think may solve the problem. Anyway, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. Let's go ahead and hear from Representative Edwards on, I think, a different bill.
Yeah, but the same bill as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm state representative in West Eugene Junction City. I would like to echo some of the sentiments given previously on House Bill 3177, the one that that Representative Freeman was testifying to previously. I won't belabor that point. I am a co-sponsor of the bill. I wanted to state one more time that I think he's spot on for a number of reasons why we should move that bill. The bill specifically I want to bring to you today is House Bill 3086. It is a simple tax credit bill. And I know that tax credit bills are not simple, especially this session, but what it does is fairly straightforward. After passage of the ethanol bill last legislative session, I, along with probably many of you, started receiving emails complaining about the mandate and some asserting that they had actually suffered engine damage to their vehicles or small motors or their boats, power saws, what have you. And so as I thought about it, I figured, well, if we pass this bill in the name of the public good, then it seems appropriate to me that the public would help make these folks whole for the cost incurred in having to repair engine damage. And so this bill that I bring to you today, House Bill 3086, provides for a tax credit of up to $1,000, and I will say that $1,000 was an arbitrary number that was picked because of its roundness and simplicity, but it would provide for tax credit up to $1,000 for the amount of the cost of the repair, whichever is less, and should somebody incur engine damage that needs to be fixed because of the use of ethanol. Now, while I have articulated why I think we ought to do this anyway, if you don't agree with that and you're against this bill because you fear the fiscal impact of the state, then I would say that you are arguing that there has been significant engine damage. I mean, if there is significant financial impact to the state, then that means that there are a whole lot of Oregonians that are applying for this tax credit because their small motors have been damaged due to ethanol. If there has not been actually that much engine damage caused by ethanol in the fuel, then I would argue that, in fact, the fiscal impact of the state is going to be minimal. So that's the essence of the bill, and I thank you for hearing it and giving it your due consideration.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
It's great to see you, Chris. Representative Edwards, it's an excellent argument. It was related to my question. I guess my response to your excellent argument is, unless some apply or many apply with questionable claims. And so the question I have is, what's the mechanism or set of mechanisms for reviewing, adjudicating, resolving sort of a set of people who requested? Do you just say, I want it, and then you get it? Is there some sort of board? Do we create a new bureaucracy? Tell me about that a little bit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that's a perfect question, and I agree with that concern. The bill would provide for a rulemaking process for certifying mechanics, the bill as currently written is fairly undescriptive in how that would move forward. Frankly, I needed to get the bill in by a deadline. I was able to accomplish that, and should there be interest by the committee, I would be happy to really flesh that out and spend a lot of time getting that making sure that process is credible, because what you say is exactly true.
Any further questions for the representatives? Thank you very much for testifying.
Thank you.
Well, we're joined by just about a quorum of the legislature now, I think. Representative Kenemer.
Mr. Chairman and Committee, for the record, Bill Kenemer, State Rep from District 39, Canby, Oregon City area. Thank you very much for the courtesy and the opportunity to talk about House Bill 3277 and obviously the ethanol bill, and I've had the luxury of not listening to all of what's being said. I guess I introduced this bill because out of concern for it being passed into law last time, and I think it needs some evaluation. It's interesting, as I was campaigning, it became a surprising issue with people talking about things. We were just hearing about damage to two-cycle engines and that kind of thing. I'll reduce mileage. You know, I know my own little Toyota, I lose 2 miles to the gallon on ethanol. My wife's car loses 3. And it's hard to find clear gasoline for my boat motor, so I end up adding some expensive chemicals that I don't think are particularly good for the environment either. And I just the reason I wanted to have it studied is I think maybe we overreacted. We had to figure out whether it really is a good idea or not. All of us want to be green. We want to do the right thing in Oregon. We want to reduce emissions, but we also want to minimize damage. Lots of people talk to me about the damage to their two-cycle engines and you know, like maintenance equipment and that kind of thing, as well as some cars. So that's the short and sweet version. I think you've probably heard lots of others. But I'd like to see it studied and decide what we should do. Maybe it's an appropriate thing in certain applications. We discovered it certainly wasn't appropriate in airplanes, for example. Well, I think for boat engines, that's true as well. And we ought to do some others. And this program of having clear premium, while a good idea, I live out in the Oregon City area, and my nearest dealer is about 20-some miles. That's not a very convenient location, even in a metropolitan area, to find clear gasoline for my boat engine.
Thank you, Representative. I think your intention with this bill is similar to the intention of this committee hearing, which is to explore some of these issues, and
yes.
We'll see about moving forward or not, but appreciate the sentiment that brings it forward. Is there any questions for Representative Kinnemer? Seeing none. Representative Bernhardt.
Mr. Chair, it isn't really a question for the good representative. It's really a comment on your comment of a minute ago, and that is simply to note that the last time I saw this many people in a room talking about ethanol, we were discussing a beer tax.
When was that, Representative?
Nice shot.
Senator Walker, I hope we'd have some Senate participation in this as well.
Well, I'm at a little bit at a disadvantage because I don't know what has all been said while I've been out of the room in my own committee. But
lots of positive things about ethanol.
Oh, really? Well, I'm about to dispel that notion. So, Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I hate ethanol. I'm just going to tell you that right up front. So, I, like many of you who are here, those of you who are not, don't have to own up to this, but we all voted for this thing. And I'm not liking what's happened, and let me tell you why. I'm sure you've heard it all, but I actually drafted a couple of bills this session. I was really smart and creative, thought I was going to be chairing a policy committee, and it was my choice not to, but at the time I thought I was chairing a policy committee, so I drafted two bills related to commodities. One I knew would go to some other committee, and one I knew would come to my education committee because it was about school commodities. And I was going to gut and stuff that with ethanol because I knew I wouldn't get an ethanol bill out of the Senate Environment Committee. So here I am in your committee testifying because I feel so passionately about it. What I have been trying to do in my bill, and the one I filed I didn't like, was simply to prohibit adding ethanol to premium gas, anything over 91 octane, so that we have unblended fuel available at the gas tank. I will tell you that last summer, OPB came to my house, did an interview with me, and rode with me in my hybrid vehicle out to Cedar Flats to pick up premium fuel so I could put it in my lawnmower, because ethanol is horrible for small engines, as you've most likely heard. So I had to drive 15 miles one way to buy one gas can full of pure premium. I would do that again to put it in my motorcycle, because I ride a motorcycle, and I tell you, ever since I've had to put ethanol in it, my motorcycle doesn't ride well. Now, you could say that's the rider, but I will tell you it is not. It does a lot of jerking, and I'm very uncomfortable with it, and during the winter when you don't ride as much, if you leave the ethanol blended fuel in the tank, it's not good or healthy on your gas tank. So that was what I was trying to do with the ethanol changes. I have heard from complaints all over the state about the ethanol mandate, and as you know, the various states around us did different things. Washington did 2%, Idaho actually did something quite different, and Oregon, unfortunately, said we will blend all of our ethanol, all of our gasoline with 10% ethanol. It really doesn't matter at this point because the federal government really controls this issue. Ethanol blending is now entirely under the control of the federal government since the Energy Independence and Security Act and the Food Conservation and Energy Act of 2008. And that law was passed before Oregon passed its law, so I'm not quite sure what we were thinking. Terminals do the ethanol blending because, as you know, the oil companies won't run the ethanol through their pipelines. So somebody's making money because suddenly we're getting octane gas at a lower level so they can add more ethanol to it and blend it. I will tell you that there is article after article that will tell you what ethanol is doing to the world market on food. Time magazine ran a story in April of 2008 reporting that one person could be fed 365 days on the corn needed to fill an ethanol-fueled SUV. The silent tsunami in The Economist in April of 2008. And I actually read The Economist, believe it or not.
Do I.
I just don't like the editorials. But The Economist is a great magazine. A wave of food inflation is moving through the world, leaving riots and shaking governments in its wake. The price reflects changes in demand, not problems in supply, and part of the problem is, quote, voracious appetites of Western biofuels programs, which convert cereals into fuel. The U.S. Department of Agriculture even noted that the use of feed crops for biofuels coupled with greater food demand spurred by high-income growth in populous countries has reversed the long-term trend of declining prices for commodities, but what it has done is created a problem for import-dependent countries who must import these crops in order to feed their citizens. Biofuel production is also leading to deforestation, and you're going to appreciate this one, Mr. Chair, because deforestation accounts for 20% of all current carbon emissions, and we're very deeply engaged in the issue of carbon emissions. Evidence also points that we divert water resources. As you know, it takes something like 1,700 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of ethanol, but you've heard all that today. So I don't expect this legislature to admit that it was wrong or admit that it was sort of misdirected or admit that it made a new law that they thought was in good faith going to work well, but it doesn't. And so I'm just one of the growing many in this state who are very confused and upset by the use of ethanol, corn-based ethanol. And I will tell you, cellulosic ethanol, I don't think is much better, uses quite a bit more energy than it produces. So there you have it. There are other things that we can do to reduce our fuel consumption, like switching to hybrid vehicles. But I will tell you that since we've had the hybrid vehicle, when we first bought it, it got over 42 miles to the gallon. And when we started adding ethanol, my average tank is about 36. So that's not so hot. And that isn't why I spent $25,000 to buy that car. But I did get myself a state tax credit. So, and I will tell you that we also gave state tax credits for ethanol facilities, and I didn't think we needed to do that because the federal government had mandated that we were going to use blended gasoline. And as you probably know, Pacific Ethanol in January of this year announced its intention to temporarily suspend operations of its 40 million gallon per year ethanol facility located in Madera, California. So we jumped in with our head and our both of our feet, and I'm just hoping that we can back it out and find balance in the system. And it's really about balance. It's not getting rid of ethanol because I see it as part of our mandate to lower our energy needs, but I think there needs to be a balance about how much of it we use so that we protect the food supply and we allow people who wish to use other fuel the right to do so at a higher cost.
Thank you very much,
Senator. That's my testimony.
Thanks. Let's see if there are any questions. Representative Boone?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Senator Walker, for coming in and saying all that. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm sure some of my environmental...
I did say a lot of things that people hadn't said yet, so...
Oh, well, good. I'm glad, Mr. Chair and Representative Boone.
Brought it home, so thank you very much.
I have environmental friends that are... I feel the pins in my back right now. And but they are really things that we need to think about. Sometimes when we do things, we don't do them completely accurately and without all the information that we need. And I think it's time to look at it again. So that would be my view. And whether it plays well politically or not, that's not really why we do things here. It's whether it plays well in the market and plays well in the whole world order. And I think that's where we're in trouble.
Thank you very much, Senator.
You're welcome.
Appreciate you being here.
See you in a bit.
See ya. Well, we've heard from all the legislators who I expect to appear today. We have about 45 minutes remaining for public comment. I hope the public will indulge our hearing from legislators who, of course, represent the public, and I hope that many of their concerns were expressed by legislators, because we're going to have to move relatively quickly through this public comment section. I'll start by bringing back up Dr. Perry, but I'm also going to ask several people who have traveled a good distance to be here to come to the dais. So Carrie Atia and Gary Neal, if you would join Dr. Perry at the dais. We'll hear from all of you in relatively short order. Please, we have a timer, and I intend to use it. And looking at, it's going to be, if we're going to move through everybody, it's going to be about 3 minutes each, folks. So that means brief. Please know that if you submit written comments, we'll read those, we'll add them to our bill file, and encourage you to summarize your testimony to the extent possible. Dr. Perry.
Thank you. My name is Greg Perry. I'm a professor of agriculture and resource economics at Oregon State University. I was asked to come and speak today because of my experience last fall putting together a conference at Oregon State University dealing with higher food and energy prices. The report summarizing the results of that conference and pulling together a lot of other information I have here in a draft form. It should be in final form in a couple of weeks. I'll leave that with Representing Wingrad's office, so that if anybody or your staff would like to see that, it's a very good and comprehensive report on ethanol and biofuels, and good and bad. But let me speak to a couple issues that have been brought up here so far. I think it's true, based on the work that we've done on this report and our conference, that we have food and energy markets tied together like they have never been tied together since horse and buggy days of our great-grandparents. And we have to ask ourselves whether that's good policy. That's point number one. Point number two, we've had an ethanol industry that has been subsidized and now has been supported through mandates since the early 1980s or late 1970s, so almost 30 years of subsidies. And yet the economists who came to our conference pretty much were in agreement that the industry would die without these subsidies. So you have to ask yourself, how long do these subsidies need to continue to make this industry viable? It is true that the MTBE, which was added to fuel for anti-knocking and so forth, has been banned, and ethanol has been found to be a good economic substitute. So the ethanol industry would not completely go away. But it would be much smaller than it is today if there were no subsidies. And following up on Senator Walker's comments, it is true, based on a lot of research that's been done, that corn ethanol in particular has a lot of very negative, well, let's not say very, but certainly a lot of negative externalities, negative impacts on the environment, particularly erosion, and clearing of land and all the greenhouse gases that will be released. Ethanol also creates a lot of nitrous oxide when burned that is more so than gas, and nitrous oxide is what causes or adds to smog. So those three points and then one more. I think corn-based ethanol in particular is not a good idea for Oregon. I don't think we have a comparative advantage in that. We don't grow corn, so we have to bring corn in. It's the same argument that you would use for why we don't grow hogs in Oregon, because it's cheaper to take the animals to the feed than it is to bring the feed to the animals. And so the idea here is you make ethanol where the corn is. You don't make ethanol here and bring the corn here.
Thank you very much, and did a remarkable job summarizing that in just under 3 minutes. Is there somewhere we could go online or elsewhere to see the proceedings of this conference or papers associated with the event that you hosted?
Yes. There, on the first page here is a website address. We have videos of all the conference talks as well as hard copies of all of them. So, yeah.
And that's part of your written submission to the committee?
So I will give this, if you would like this or if you'd like me to give this to...
If you would give it to her, that would be great.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks very much. And we'll see if there are any questions after we finish the panel. But again, moving along quickly, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman Cannon and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Atia, and I'm Director of Public Affairs for Ziachem Incorporated, located in Lakewood, Colorado. I will summarize my written testimony that I've submitted this afternoon. Ziachem has proposed to build its first cellulosic biorefinery in Boardman, Oregon. Ziachem has partnered with Greenwood Resources to supply fast-growing hybrid poplar trees from their Boardman tree farm as the feedstock to the biorefinery. Greenwood Resources develops and manages sustainable, environmentally certified trees that help reduce reliance on natural forests and non-renewable energy resources. CH2M Hill has been selected as the engineering, procurement, and construction contractor for this project, and engineering design is currently underway. Construction of the biorefinery will begin later this year, and Ziachem expects to have product online in mid-2010. This advanced biofuels project will contribute positive economic development and create green jobs in eastern Oregon. Peak construction jobs are estimated at 75, and approximately 20 new jobs will be created for operation of the facility. As an advanced biofuels producer preparing to deploy its technology in the state of Oregon, Ziachem does not support House Bill 2559. Passage of this bill will put a halt to the progress made by this industry to date. In addition, the bill may force new business development and job creation outside the state of Oregon. It is imperative to all biofuels partners, including investors, feedstock providers, biofuels producers, local communities, product offtake partners, and consumers, that Oregon continue a long-term approach to support alternative fuels. As the biofuels industry continues to grow and develop, being aware of and understanding the latest studies and reports is important to ensure that public policy reflects the current state of science and technology. Regarding House Bill 3277, Ziachem respectfully requests that the Department of Environmental Quality examine the recent waiver that was submitted by Growth Energy to the United States Environmental Protection Agency to increase ethanol blends up to 15% or E15. The waiver is supported by a number of alternative fuel coalitions, including 9 cellulosic ethanol producers, including Ziachem. The waiver includes the most recent studies of higher ethanol blends conducted by the federal government, national laboratories, and universities. The results are overwhelmingly supportive of higher ethanol blends. Ziachem looks forward to being a part of the biofuels industry here in the state of Oregon. I thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and hear from our third panelist and then go forward with questions. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Cannon and members of the committee, my name is Gary Neal. I'm the general manager of the Port of Morrow, located in Morrow County, Oregon. Port of Morrow, Morrow County citizens in our region and the state of Oregon have all benefited from the implementation of a renewable fuel standard for the state of Oregon. The 2007 biofuels legislation enabled a major capital investment to be made at the Port of Morrow. Pacific Ethanol constructed a 42 million gallon a year per year corn ethanol facility. This facility cost in excess of $100 million. It took approximately 14 months to construct and has generated 40 good-paying jobs at the plant. The environmental benefit of blending gasoline with 10% ethanol is well documented. It continues to be a huge contribution in reducing CO and CO2. The opportunity to have this plant at the Port of Morrow secures a reliable source of Oregon's blending needs for gasoline. The facility is strategically located to allow for the low cost of river transportation of the finished product to the Portland refineries for the blending to take place. Our location with the intersection of the Columbia River and the Union Pacific mainline also allows Pacific Ethanol to utilize production from outside the region to be railed here and transloaded to the barge system. Ethanol from this facility is a backhaul for the barging operations that causes greater efficiency and direct environmental benefits by utilizing already existing barges that previously returned to Portland empty. The byproduct, distillers' wet grains, is a great feed supplement for our cattle businesses that have the contracts to receive this product. Approximately 17 or 14 semi-loads per day are shipped to various cattle feedlots and dairies throughout our region. So high-quality feedstock most definitely is well received by the customers who use this product. The process of creating ethanol and utilizing the byproduct for cattle feed creates multiple benefits for utilizing field corn. Most of the corn is railed into the facility by unit trains from the Midwest or Canada. The facility receives approximately one train every 8 days for the production needs. With a reliable market for the ethanol produced at the Port of Marl, Pacific Ethanol is working diligently to move forward with the next generation of ethanol production, which is a cellulosic ethanol facility. They are planning on constructing a test facility at the port that utilizes agricultural waste. This technology requires additional testing in order to construct a full-scale production facility for the market. These test facilities are very capital-intensive. For the Pacific Ethanol project, on the drawing board, it's approximately $50 million. I know that everyone would like to see the next generation of ethanol production move forward utilizing waste-type products for feedstock. However, in the meantime, corn ethanol production needs to continue in order to get to that next step. You need to make sure that the commitment the legislature gave in 2007 is maintained so that facilities like Pacific Ethanol that have made major capital investments based on those commitments can maintain and survive these delicate times we're living in. They need to have the reliability of markets so they can move forward with plans to test the next generation of renewable fuels in the cellulosic production. Please hold the course that you have established and committed so that we can move forward with the existing programs in renewable fuels and even better benefits to our society. And Ziachem is an additional customer of ours that we're looking forward to having their operations move ahead as well. And this is an important issue to the Port of Marl and Marl County. Thank you.
Thank you very much for making the trip today to be here. Appreciate that. Any quick questions? We do have a number of folks still signed up to testify. Representative Smith?
Representative Horner.
Thank you. Quickly, do you know what age poplar trees you're going to be using?
Chair Cannon, Representative Barnhart. The poplar trees are very fast growing. They're harvested at approximately 2 to 3 years of age by a system called coppicing, where they are harvested above ground level, which allows the tree then to re-sprout so that you are maintaining the carbon in the soil. You can go through and do 5 cuttings before you have to replant. So you're only actually replanting and having to penetrate the soil about every 15 years. So it's
Thank
a
you.
Very sustainable way of harvesting.
Thank you very much.
Representative
Thank you.
Bailey.
Just to follow up on Representative Barnhart's question. So between that and it looks like you have a process for making the ethanol from these poplar trees that doesn't involve CO2 release, what's the life cycle profile for the carbon for your biofuel versus, say, traditional biofuels?
Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, our process is feedstock agnostic. We're able to use a wide variety of cellulosic feedstocks, whether it's hybrid poplar trees or other sources, including agricultural or forest residues, herbaceous crops. We have done a life cycle analysis that was put on by a third party called CELOC Technology about 1 year ago that demonstrated a net energy ratio, or if you think about it, how much energy you put into the process, how much energy you get out. We had a 12-fold increase in the amount of energy output per unit of energy input. On a CO2 analysis, we had approximately 8 times less carbon emissions on a life cycle analysis compared to corn ethanol and 11 times less than traditional gasoline.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go next to a couple other folks who have traveled a good ways to be here. Lee Gossett and it looks like Ron Running. I'm not reading the last part of this, Summit Natural Energy. So if the two of you as well as David Martin could form a panel, please. Yeah, quick thought from Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The ethanol debate is very interesting because all of the sides haven't yet calcified, right? For so many of the things that come to testify, you know who's a for and who's again before anybody shows up. And I think that one thing would be helpful for at least me is if people can, who are, you know, on the various bills, be getting together so we can figure out what a set of moderate policies might be for ethanol. So it's not just a set of yes or no decisions, but guidance on what's the smartest way for us to go with a variety of these things. I'll shut up now, but that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Thanks, Representative Smith. Mr. Gossett?
Yes, sir, Representative Cannon and fellow committee members, thank you very much for allowing me to come before you today. I've got a handout that's coming to you, a little bit of confusion about which bill was being addressed here, whether it be 25, 59, or 3177. But anyway, I'll just start out here. My testimony today will concentrate on the damaging effects of ethanol being blended with automotive fuel. Your packets of information contain factual data I have obtained from the following sources: Federal Aviation Administration, Kohler Engine Technician Service Program, Colvin Oil Company, Hubbard's Ace Hardware Small Engine Repair Division, Wolford Equipment, Crater Chainsaw. In your packets, I've highlighted key paragraphs from the Federal Aviation Administration and Kohler Engine Company that documents the damaging effects of ethanol in automotive fuel. I personally have contacted the following businesses in Southern Oregon, and this is what they had to say about blended ethanol in automotive fuel. Colvin Oil Company. Colvin is the bulk plant supplier in Southern Oregon for Chevron products. I spoke to the manager about blended fuel, ethanol added to automotive fuel, and here's what he had to say. Ethanol draws moisture into the fuel and sinks to the bottom of the tank. It is a blended, if blended fuel is used in a steel tank, it will loosen any rust and deposits and place them in suspension in the fuel. This can be filtered out but shortens the life of the filter. Ethanol attacks aluminum and will corrode it. Blended fuel has one-half the storage life of unblended fuel. Hubbard's Ace Hardware, Small Engine Repair Division. The Small Engine Repair Division manager also confirmed ethanol blended fuel has one-half the storage life of, as unblended gasoline, and also confirms ethanol will corrode aluminum and rubber components that are not made specifically to withstand ethanol. Wolford Equipment, supplier of chainsaws and yard tractors. The owner, Dale Wolford, told me ethanol eats away at fuel lines and leaves gunk material in the carburetor, resulting in costly repairs to the customer. Mr. Wolford also told me to never leave a blended fuel mix in the chainsaw. When finished using the chainsaw, run it completely out of fuel. Crater Chainsaw. They supply chainsaws and small engine equipment. The small engine mechanic at Crater Chainsaw echoed the statements made by Wolford Equipment and went on to say that the engine problems they have encountered started with using blended fuel. I own two aircraft. Both aircraft have been issued a supplemental type certificate by the Federal Aviation Administration. This STC authorizes me to operate my aircraft on auto fuel, but specifically prohibits the use of auto fuel that contains ethanol because of problems associated with it. The attached special airworthiness information bulletin issued by the FAA lists the reasons for this ruling.
If you would wrap up, please.
Okay. In conclusion, I feel the voting public should have the right to choose at the pump to use blended or unblended automotive gasoline. In my opinion, the simple solution to this issue is to exempt premium 91-octane gasoline from being blended. I'm sure you're well aware of the political pressure being brought to bear on the voting public to force us to use blended automotive gasoline. This is your chance to bring some balance to this one-sided issue and exempt premium 91-octane automotive gasoline from the statement, from the mandate. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And it is, as you've corrected, 3177 that would do exactly what you're describing.
Okay.
At the end of this testimony. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi. Representative Cannon, committee members. My name is Ron Ronigan with Summit Natural Energy. We are close to completing construction of a 2-million-gallon ethanol facility in Cornelius, Oregon. And I would just like to make a few comments on behalf of ethanol. As opposed to a great many people in this room, I love ethanol. And very simply, it is the best solution that we have to a fossil fuel issue that is not going to go away. I'd also like to make comments that the industry is really in its infancy. And although our plant will be, our feedstock will be 100% waste stream from our fruit processing operations and other related food manufacturers within the valley, that product will be donated to us. We still have close ties to the corn people because again, simply it's the best solution that we have, and the corn guys are getting more efficient every day, and the cellulosic thing is coming on strong. And regarding the House Bill 2725, I see some issues there, I'd like to make a little comment on the, just briefly, on the cost of the issue between ethanol and the cost of food. I trade ethanol every day, and we closely watch. Last summer corn futures went to $8. Everybody's screaming about ethanol, but corn futures are now, they closed today at, I think, 358. They retraced about 60%. Ethanol production has continued at the static, if not increased a little bit. So the relationship between ethanol and the increased price of food is, I take deference to that. And it's just fundamentally obvious, What I haven't seen is some of the food manufacturers reflect their lower acquisition cost on their ingredients now. So, but more specifically to 2725, if you take away the tax incentive for biomass that's fit for human consumption, what we use for feedstock is various types. Say somebody has some barley that's slightly off grade, and that's an ideal feedstock for us to ferment and convert into ethanol, and this would preclude them from getting the tax credit, and I would like you to take that in consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll see if there are any questions in a moment. Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, Chairman. My name is Dave Martin. I'm recent past president of the Oregon Pilots Association, and although I signed up first, I think Joe Smith, who's the current president, arranged to go first. So if I may change places with
absolutely.
Him.
Absolutely. I thought you told me the reverse.
If you have...
I misunderstood my instructions, so we'll swap you out.
If you have time for me, I've cut my comments down to about a minute.
Okay.
Joe Smith, president of the Oregon Pilots Association. One does never begin testifying by correcting a member of the committee. But I don't hate ethanol. I do, however, recognize that ethanol was sold as a substitute fuel because it was supposed to reduce the energy cost of fossil fuels. Apparently, that is clearly true for sugarcane. I am delighted to hear that it may be true for poplar trees. I submit that ethanol from corn is snake oil peddled by corporate farmers in Iowa who have deluded many of my fellow environmentalists into making it a cause du jour, the principal result of which has been to increase the cost of feed and food to the American public. But even if I didn't feel out about ethanol, I would be here today speaking on behalf of the aviation community for three reasons. First, as has been mentioned, ethanol eats away older gaskets, seals, and hoses, and corrodes aluminum, so it's a real threat to many older aircraft. Second, it reacts to composite fuel tanks, so it's a real threat to many modern aircraft. But the biggest reason is that ethanol sucks up water. It mixes with water. Those of you who have ever flown a small airplane and watched the pilot get ready for the flight may have noticed that one of the things he or she does is take a cylinder and drain some gas and look at it. What they're looking to see is if there's water, because water can condense in any fuel tank and go to the gas tank. Water, being heavier than gas, drops to the bottom of the fuel tank, and therefore you can drain it out. Now, the reason that that's important is if you have water in your car engine and it coughs a few times, no big deal. If you're at 3,000 feet, or even worse, at 500 feet, it is a very big deal. So we get it out. But if there is ethanol in the gas, the ethanol mixes with the water, so it stays there. And then if you get to an altitude at which the temperature is below freezing, the water freezes, and it can then clog up in the fuel line. That, again, is not a matter of pulling over. That's a fairly serious problem for somebody in an aircraft. If you get enough water in mixed with the ethanol, it actually will drain to the bottom. And so, good, that will be removed when you sump the tank. Problem with that is that ethanol is being used to raise the octane. So if that you get that much water in there that it sucks the ethanol out, so there's no ethanol left in that gas because of the way they are doing it now, you may have octane of 80 or even 75. And in an engine where you need 91, you're at 7,000 feet in a cloud. That's a very serious problem. And so that is why it is really, really important. I am here, my testimony says here on 3177. I am delighted to hear from some of the early testimony, and we're particularly grateful to Representatives Freeman and Gilman and Hannah for recognizing this problem and bringing it to the legislature. I'm delighted to hear that there might be enough of a market that if you have simply allow it, that this problem will be solved. We would much prefer to see it mandated that clear gas be the 91 octane or better. The correction clearly does need to be made for 91 octane rather than 92. And I would be delighted to answer any questions. And this is kind of a big deal for me because this is the first chance I've had to do this.
I'll see if there are any questions. Representative Jefferson, sir.
I would just like to say to the committee that now perhaps certain things are becoming clearer. And I will reserve the rest of my questions for later.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the one person that in the room that appears to be in favor of ethanol. I'm just curious about conversion ratios. And you mentioned that they're getting more efficient. So what is the conversion ratio for corn? That is, do we get one gallon of ethanol for half a gallon of other fuel going into the production of it? I'm not quite sure of the production ratio methodology, but what is it?
I cannot. If I might ask, Mark, do you know the answer to that? It's President of my company. Tyson?
You're going to need to come up to the dais to introduce yourself and answer the question.
I'm not an expert on the corn.
We'll bring you up for this question. Just come and introduce yourself for the record.
While he's on his way up, I hope that that answer relates not just to the cost of the creation of it, but the loss in energy when you're burning it, because those needed to be added together.
All right, let's give a chance.
Maybe a question to clarify my question. The conversion ratio for sugarcane I understood to be 9 or 10 to 1, and corn I understood to be around 2. But that's an understanding. I just want to know what the real of it was.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Tyson Kiever, and Representative Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Chair, excuse me, not Representative Chair. I would concur about a two-time gain for ethanol. And another question I would ask the committee to look into is what is the conversion factor of a recovered gallon of petroleum? It's a loss. That's the alternative.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Thank you very much for being here today, particularly those who traveled some distance to be here. Let's move on to Charles Carlson, Dan Motley, and Dean Billing. In the order you arrived, gentlemen, so we'll start with you.
Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee, I'm Charles Carlson, I'm President of Cascade Grain Products. And maybe this will come on or not. I'm here, of course, in favor of ethanol. We have a large plant in Klaskanai there, and we bring in corn from the Midwest, and we provide ethanol for both Oregon and Washington. We provide our feed for both states as well. And, of course, right now we've seen massive growth in our ethanol industry. And this last year, we produced 9.2 billion of gallons of ethanol in the United States. We'll produce over 10 billion in this coming year. And, of course, we've imported 566 million in 2008 that came from Brazil Caribbean Institute. I'm going to jump really quickly through some of this. A lot has been talked about artificial grain, high-priced grain prices that ran up this year, and what are we doing as far as effective food? And that's not working. Yeah. Well, corn futures out mid-July came near to $8, and then it started to collapse. And we collapsed below $3 into December futures and have come back since then. Why did that take place? It was not because we didn't have adequate corn. There was a lot of non-commercial speculation in the farm markets, both the grain industry, the petroleum, and the energy industry that ran it up. One of the figures we have in here would show that the large percentage of non-commercial net longs in that time frame was what was driving up the price of corn, not that we didn't have adequate supplies. And so the role of the spectators was the largest last year. A lot of that money is hedge fund money, pension fund money that came into the commodity markets, and it drove the price of corn up and energy prices. But the annual corn supply continues has grown and has met the increased demand. Corn yields are increasing on a yearly basis. We're up to, but this last year was 153 bushels per acre. We've hit as high as 160, and that continues to increase. So this last year we grew about 12 billion bushels worth of corn. Corn stocks are also strong. We are carrying over this year about 1.8 billion bushels of corn. Only about 10% of the corn crop is actually used for human consumption and industrial uses. A lot of it is for feed and export. Why we're out here, 20 to 25% of the corn exports come off the Pacific Northwest. So we grab a small portion of that corn that's already coming this direction, and we convert it to ethanol, and we convert it to feed, and a lot of our feed goes to the local industry. There we are. That's where we're showing corn carryouts. Land area in use, we've talked a lot about do we have adequate land in the United States for increased production for biofuels crops. The total rural is 2.2 billion. 442 million of that is cropland. And next page, the rest, trying to look through that, 340 million was actually put into cropland. 40 million was idle in CRP. Back in the 80s, we developed the Conservation Reserve Program. In 2002, about 32 million acres was idled. A Conservation Reserve Program, of course, was put in because of excess surplus agricultural stocks. So that ground is still sitting idle, a lot of it, and there's other ground that is available for production. In the farm value of what the farmer receives in the food prices, it's only 19% of that food dollar. If you take a look at that, labor other is the biggest other portion of the food dollar, but the farmer gets a very small portion of the food dollar. But the big, as we get into the renewable fuels, ethanol, down the biomass ethanol, cellulosic, which is going to be the big production down the road, that'll come from agricultural residue, it'll come from wood, it will come from wood waste, it will also come from municipal solid waste. All these are currently in pilot plants or are coming into commercial production. We have limited amounts that we can do with corn, and we're getting close to that, and basically those plants are built. Our growth in ethanol will come from cellulosic. And as far as what we are doing now, we are improving on our corn. We produce about 2.8 gallons of ethanol out of a bushel of corn. We produce about 17.5 pounds of feed out of every bushel of corn that we put through our plant.
Mr. Carlson, I give you some extra time because of the technical difficulties. If you would wrap it up, that would be great.
That's just a summary of tax incentives comparing the oil industry to the ethanol industry. The biggest one, the ethanol industry, the funder's credit check goes to the final. And the last slide showed just greenhouse gas reductions, and that was the one they were saying. It's 51% less greenhouse gases than gasoline.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's wait, and I suspect there may be a question or two for you, but let's hear from our other panelists. Go ahead.
Yeah. Chairman Cannon, members of the committee. My name is Dan Motley, and I'm not here on behalf of any group. I like to think that I represent people that have cars like mine, trucks like mine. I'm a vehicle enthusiast. I got my first car when I was 13 years old and took it apart and put it back together and bought another one and did the same thing and continued to do so. I worked for Chrysler Corporation as a mechanic for a little bit, worked in gas stations when I was a kid, and et cetera. But speaking on the whole for these several bills, referring to House Bill 3086, I am concerned that it isn't clear what period we would be talking about for any given tax credit, whether that's per year or multiple times per year or per lifetime or once per vehicle or whatever. Number two, I'd like to make note that there are parts besides engines that are important. In my case, I have a 78 Dodge pickup. It's called a Little Red Express. There were 2,118 of them manufactured. They have a composite gas tank. Every day that ethanol-laced gasoline sits in my tank, it eats my tank. Someday, I'm not going to be able to run my little truck anymore to the collector shows or anything because I won't have a gas tank. For a while, we can repair it. Tax credits are good, but eventually it won't be repairable, and the gas tank is not replaceable. We're talking about a vehicle that's already 30-plus years old, and you just don't go down to the local Dodge dealer and buy a gas tank. Also, I think it's important that when you address engines in here as to what constitutes an engine, because if you look at a lot of warranties, both manufacturer's warranties and aftermarket warranties, they've begun to dissect the engine. The carburetor is not the engine. The fuel pump is not the engine. The fuel lines are not the engine. The fuel tank is not the engine. The pickup is not the engine. The sending unit is not the engine, etc. And in my case, it's my gas tank that's disappearing. It's my fuel pickup that's disappearing. It's my fuel filter that's disappearing, okay? Not the one that you commonly think of that gas stations replace or something. I have a fuel filter in my gas tank as well as up on the engine from the factory. Almost all vehicles have a filter in the tank, the older vehicles. And that filter is made out of also a composite material. Ethanol eats that composite material. So little by little, that material is going into my engine. Not a big deal because it can handle that. The combustion burns it. Problem is, eventually the filter is gone. And to replace it, I have to pull the gas tank, find another one of those little filters, and put it on, put it back together, etc.
If you would conclude, please.
Concerning Bill 3177?
Very briefly.
I urge you to include special interest vehicles. The citation that I found, probably wrong, but ORS 805020 is the licensing of them. I suspect that those were left out when this was set up to avoid damages and stuff. There are more special interest vehicles than there are antique vehicles. Special interest vehicles are not just anything driving down the street. It's something that is so unique, it's destined to be an antique. It simply is later than 1954 and 1955 right now.
Thank you.
My truck.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and we really do appreciate citizens being down here, not on behalf of anybody necessarily, but undoubtedly expressing the point of view of many folks out there. So thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, Representative Cannon and members of the committee. I'm Dean Billing from Sisters, Oregon, and I represent a coalition across the country that's trying to get ethanol-free premium gasoline.
I'm opposed to HB 2559 in its present form. It is a fatally flawed bill unless it prohibits the blending of ethanol and premium unleaded gasoline. While this bill has a laudatory objective of repealing the ethanol mandate of HB 2210, the Oregon ethanol mandate no longer affects ethanol blending in the state of Oregon. In addition, this bill would repeal the exemptions of SB 1079 without providing any alternative way to get ethanol-free gasoline for those engine applications that must have it. In its present form, HB 2559 will do further damage to the marine, aviation, and small engine economy in Oregon. The federal RFS mandate of the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007 is now driving all ethanol blending due to an unintended consequence. ESA 2007 defines a renewable fuel as E85 and was designed to boost E85 production and distribution and development of flex fuel vehicles. That is now a dead issue because ethanol costs more than gasoline, and when a flex fuel vehicle uses E85, its mileage decreases by 25 to 30%. An ever-increasing amount of ethanol is mandated to be produced each year under ESA 2007, and it has to be blended into gasoline, so it is showing up as E10 everywhere. The ethanol industry is pushing to have the blending limit for non-flex fuel cars raised to at least E15, and they have hired General Wesley Clark as their spokesman, and the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, former governor of Iowa, is pushing for it, so it will probably happen in the near future. The only part of ethanol blending that Oregon now has a chance of controlling is whether we will have at least one grade of ethanol-free fuel universally available to protect our citizens from the property damage that ethanol blending can do. The legislature can prohibit the blending of ethanol in all premium unleaded gasoline. That is not in conflict with ESA 2007, since it is not a mandatory E10 law. Other states have prohibited the blending of ethanol in premium unleaded, like Missouri and Montana, although the Montana mandatory E10 law that predated the Oregon law has never triggered and probably never will. I urge the legislature to modify this bill with language to prohibit the blending of ethanol in all premium unleaded gasoline or defeat the bill before it causes more economic damage than our current ethanol laws already have done. For HB 3886, I'm opposed to it primarily because the Oregon ethanol mandate no longer controls ethanol blending in the state of Oregon. It is certainly ironic that the legislature finally recognizes that ethanol blending causes property damage. It was widely known when HB 2210 was debated that ethanol blended fuel should not be used in a number of engine applications. Every state that has passed a mandatory E10 law has had exemptions. It is still a widespread problem today because the permissive language of SB 1079 does not guarantee that every Oregonian that needs ethanol-free fuel can get it.
Mr. Billing, if you would wrap up. I know we have extensive written testimony from you.
Okay, the continuing damage will happen if E15 is allowed. I'm against HB 3177 because it has the minor flaw of the 91AKI and the major flaw that it is permissive. Laws for ethanol don't work. 3277, I'm opposed to it. We don't need to expend tax money studying the problems of ethanol. They're widely known, especially in the marine industry. There is a Coast Guard safety circular about the problems, BSC 85, so why waste my tax money on a further study? I will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And I seem to recall getting emails from you over the past couple of years, Mr. Billing.
Yes.
And you raised some interesting, I think, important issues for us to consider about the effect that these bills would have if we were to pass them today, given the changed federal policy on ethanol. So thank you. Are there any questions for the panel? Seeing none, we're going to move on to, I think, our last set. And if the committee will indulge me by sticking around for just a few more minutes, we have Catherine Higgs. Well, we're not going to squeeze them up in one panel because it's five more folks. So we're going to try to power through them. Catherine Higgs, Ron Harder, and Andrea Salinas. If you'd come up in a group, and there are two to follow that. Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Higgs, and I'm here representing Oregon dairy farmers, and I'm also a dairy farmer's daughter. And I just want to talk very briefly today. I understand we're under time constraints, so you have my written testimony, but I will just hit the high points. First thing, we feed grain to our cows, and corn's a really popular grain and has a great nutritive value for our cows. And unfortunately, the grain that our dairy farmers use is in direct competition with ethanol production. And so when you give a tax credit to those products, you're really making a disincentive for our producers and putting them at an economic disadvantage in order to feed their cows. Our feed costs, 60 to 65% of our cost of production is attributed to what we feed our cattle. So it's very expensive. And since the ethanol tax credit, our feed ingredients have increased dramatically. Part of the reason is that corn that was once being fed to our cows is being diverted into the ethanol business. And then crops like soybeans and alfalfa, which also are fed to dairy cattle, have been taken out of production, planted into corn, and that ground, that corn then is being sold for ethanol. And in 07, 08, 15.3 million acres of other crops were shifted into corn production. Last year, we tolerated these high feed prices because we had historic high milk prices, and it tells you a little bit about the breakdown there. But right now, it's the absolute opposite. We have historic low milk prices right now. Our dairymen are receiving anywhere from 50 to 60% less in their milk check this year than last year. And our feed costs have only come down maybe 10-15%. In fact, a dairyman in Tillamook County told me that he was $150,000 short last month and wasn't quite sure how to pay the feed bills and wasn't quite sure how long he could operate in that manner for. We do support renewable fuel. We do have a full-time staff person that's committed to working with dairy farmers with the implementation of manure digesters. We just don't support subsidizing the ethanol industry. And a report called Biofuel Support Policy Costs to the U.S. Economy said that in 07 and 08, the added feed costs dairy producers pay that's attributed to the production of ethanol is about 12 cents a gallon of milk. And right now we're losing anywhere from 43 to 69 cents a gallon of milk. So we can't afford any more costs to our industry.
Thank you very much. Ms. Salinas.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Environmental Council. Reducing demand should be Oregon's first priority in addressing the use of petroleum, a highly polluting and rapidly dwindling resource. But far more fuel-efficient vehicles and cleaner, lower-carbon fuels are also key to transportation's important transition away from oil. For several years, OEC has worked to support the use and production of regional, sustainably produced low-carbon biofuels. OEC recognizes that not all biofuels are created equal. If feedstock producers and biofuel processors employ unsustainable practices, then we'll end up with fuels that harm and not help the environment. But if renewable fuels are produced sustainably, they can generate substantial reductions in greenhouse gas emissions and improvements in air and water quality, as well as provide some of the economic benefits that have been discussed here today. OEC feels the majority of Northwest producers are committed to using environmentally and socially favorable practices and making their production practices transparent. If the state were to repeal the renewable fuel standard, it would harm the industry and remove the incentive for research into and development of even more environmentally friendly biofuel feedstocks and biorefinery processes. Others will speak to the merits of the bills that are intended to otherwise reduce incentives for ethanol and biodiesel production. But we hope that the committee will take a very reasoned approach to tinkering with the biofuels incentives that are in place in the state. We agree with the desire to protect consumers, but hope that those protections will be put in place only where real threats exist. Finally, we hope you will consider HB 3463, which I know it will be up next week. Oregon's biodiesel industry has demonstrated very high standards of social and environmental stewardship and is an important player in our transition to a green economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder. I'm here representing myself today, not what some folks normally think of me doing. I have a 22-foot trophy, and we worked with the legislature last year to pass 1079, which exempted marinas and aircraft airports from selling blended gas. One of the problems with that, and it was addressed by the Department of Agriculture, but I don't think with enough emphasis, there are 82 stations out of how many thousands of gas stations in Oregon that are now selling clear gas. There are 32 marinas. There is no place between Salem and Newport where I keep my boat in, or where I take my boat in the summer, and I paid $5.50 to $5.75 a gallon at the marina in Newport, and that's considerable. there is a Coast Guard bulletin that someone just talked about that does tell about the damage that ethanol does. It is quite extensive. It does rot rubber in the older boats and the gaskets. In tanks that are composite that were made before the 80s, it will disintegrate those tanks. But the biggest problem with ethanol in a boat is boats set over the winter. And if you let the boat set over the winter, you have phase separation where the water separates from the gas and it turns into sludge. It's not just water in the bottom. And the only way to get that out of there is to drain the tank. I have many, many friends who have suffered some type of damage from that phase separation. It's not a unique thing at all. And so I'm surprised to hear the Department of Agriculture saying that they have very limited numbers of that. Like the aircraft people, if you're crossing the bar, Columbia River or the bar at Newport, you don't want your boat stopping halfway across the bar. And it's not like pulling off, parking, and calling the towing company. I support 3177. We have to address the octane because gas is not delivered to the station right now without, or actually into Oregon, without being blended somewhere else. So I'm not sure 91 clear gas is available. That's something we would have to look at. We also need to keep the exceptions that are currently in the law in this particular bill if it goes forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Let's hear from the last set of panelists. Doesn't Representative Boone wants a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Catherine, for bringing up the dairy issue. We've lost a lot of dairies in this state, and a lot of them are in my district. And it's a really sad fate to suffer because it's a huge industry. It was a huge industry, and I'm not sure where those people are going to go. You have a job in sort of in the industry. That's good. But I'm glad she brought that up because between getting the feed to the animals in Tillamook because of the issue with the railroad being out, and now they're having to truck it, and that's extra cost. And it's been a real nightmare.
Appreciate that comment. The challenges that our dairy industry faces. Thank you for being here. Let's hear last from Jim Welsh and Matthew Calker. I think I have that right. Calker, Caller.
Callan.
Well, we did our best.
That's all you could expect from government, huh?
Go ahead.
I won't say it.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Mr. Welsh.
Chair Cannon and committee members, Jim Welsh here for Oregon Cattlemen Association, and Catherine Higgs said it very well. We are certainly very concerned with the feedstock crops being used for ethanol and the kind of unintended consequences that we've witnessed and experienced through this last year. I think we've learned a lot. In 2007, we really had to hustle quickly to make sure that the extra tax credit that was applied to corn here in Oregon was eliminated. And I thank you very much because you all helped us very through that effort. But the other grains that are still enjoying a tax credit, those are feedstocks too. And you know, that just ripples on down to the final consumer and increase some costs. It was really nice to hear about the poplar trees being used. We are certainly supportive of the that type of cellulosic material being used for ethanol and staying diverting away from the feedstock. So we're very supportive of that. And you heard plenty about the boats, and as a boat owner, I'm very concerned. As a two-cycle engine, multiple ones that you do have for taking care of your property, we do face some problems. And I think if you address some of those, I think it would do us well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We certainly have heard those concerns expressed today. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Matt Callan, for the record. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I just wanted to, I am sales manager and engineer for Mark Nelson Oil Products and ConocoPhillips, and I wanted to voice my support for 3177. It is the opinion of myself and my company that ethanol is biofuels in general are just a garbage product. I deal with the problems day in, day out. I see them. I work with people that work around them, and mandating ethanol for all gasoline sold at all service stations is a big mistake. So I will keep it short and sweet.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And appreciate the committee's time over the hour here. Any last questions?
Seeing none, thank you both for being here. And with that, I will close the public hearing on these bills, 2559, 2725, 3086, 3177, and 3277. Felt like we'll be there for a moment. And close the House Committee on Environment and Water.